At Best Western, we can't promise you the perfect weekend hiking trip or the perfect sunset. We cannot promise you'll make a new friend on the trail. It's certainly possible. We just can't guarantee it. And you probably shouldn't force it. But we can promise you this. With over 4,200 hotels worldwide, you can find a warm welcome and a comfortable room right on the way to where you're going. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western.
Okay, Brandon, can you hear us?
Yo.
Hey, there you are.
How's that sound?
Yeah, gotcha.
Oh, shit.
You got it.
This Matt Lunsford on, is that correct?
Aaron Lunsford here is joining us because he's our longtime tour manager.
I don't think I've met Aaron.
Maybe haven't met Aaron, but Aaron, it was a drummer in the band As Cities Burn. Aaron is a longtime Dave Bazan fan, and Dave Bazan is a longtime disliker of Aaron. So
yeah, Dave Bazan hates Aaron Lunsford. Hates a strong word, but strong dislike. Even though Aaron Lunsford loves Dave Bazan,
right?
I mean,
exactly.
He's like a big influence in your life.
It is true, actually.
That is fascinating. That's a badge of honor in some ways. What is there a podcast worthy story behind that?
Well, I'll just boil it down to me and Dave view Twitter as being for two very different purposes. So that's about the best way to say it. But I mean, I ripped off half my drum beats ever written are, for all intents and purposes, copy and pasted from Dave Bazan drum beats. So
yeah, but that's not the reason. The reason is weird Twitter shit.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Aaron, no, you are. I mean, you're an official troll, or that's what you would. I mean, even you.
Yeah,
would
yeah.
It, right?
What's funny? I've never actually trolled Dave. Really. I mean, I did ask if I could come be his drummer after he got mad at me, and I don't. I don't think he thought that was funny.
Why did he get mad at you, though?
He was mad because I was trolling some people that he liked, I guess, or something like that. And he took offense and took it seriously. But, I mean, it's fine.
Let's get right into it. I want to ask a real serious I just want to get to it. Got Brandon Vetter here, director of Strange Negotiations. You are doing this from vacation? And the big question I want to know is, where are you on vacation?
Hard-hitting journalism right here.
I don't get to take vacations, so I'm always jealous of when people do.
I know. This is the first one for us in a long time, definitely since pandemic. We're down in Santa Cruz, California. My wife's parents have a house down there, like a fishing house, and so we came down and are doing a week down here, which is like I'm just kind of hitting that spot right now where I start to feel really uncomfortable about not working, and you know, like we're like halfway through it.
We were in Santa Cruz, that's where we were on the boardwalk and indoor putt-putt and all that kind of stuff. We just were there last year.
Oh, that's where we rode the roller coaster?
Yeah, we rode a roller coaster, and I said, I got to drive my family down here for a vacation. So that's on my short list of places to try.
It's fun. You know, actually, it's funny because during the filming of the movie, we actually had Dave and I stayed here, and there's a whole scene actually here in the living room of this house where Dave is like fucking manic and kind of falling apart in an interesting way that like he's trying to rebuild a pedal board at the same time. And so sonically shit's falling apart and mentally shit's falling apart. Like his wife is calling him and there's a little bit of that conversation. I actually had this whole scene edited from when we were here that never made it in the film.
That's cool. Brandon, I want to go back to the Twitter thing. a little bit more. To me, it seems like you've spent so much time around Dave, maybe you'd have some insight into how he thinks. But I've always found his music to be so vulnerable and expressive and saying where he's really at and what he really thinks. That's like part of his art form.
Right.
Do you think now Twitter is that? Like the way he presents and acts and takes Twitter as fills that spot some?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a thing in terms of just kind of like he is reserving emotional energy for it. You know, where it's like, I can tell, you know, like there were, you know, more than three times probably that it's like, hey, what's up? What's going on? Like, what's under your skin? And it's like something on Twitter.
It might have been me.
So, and that was kind of before I was really, it, you know, like that interactive with that medium. So I didn't quite understand. But yeah, you know, I think like it's such a hard thing because I think, you know, like you're saying, Aaron, I think so many people use it for so many different reasons, you know? And that's the thing, like Dave is doing his full on honest self on Twitter, but you know, and even the jokes are like pure jokes. Actually, one of my favorite of his jokes that he ever told was on Twitter where he said, and I'm going to totally fuck this up, but something about bury me in death as I was in life. Sitting down with a lap full of croissant crumbs. I don't know why it's my favorite, but for some reason it kind of got me.
I mean, that's such even a serious joke.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There's no such thing as like, and you know, it's always rooted in that.
Is it authentic? Like, what's the core value behind all of it? Is it authenticity or a vulnerability or what makes sense out of all of it to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's got one lane, you know, in a really cool way that it's like, you know, this is, and for better or for worse in terms of its result, you know, and the way that it impacts friendships and relationships and all that stuff. But yeah, you know, I think he's kind of got one zone, and you know, everything is kind of born out of that. It's so weird. This is weird. Like I've been thinking about, you know, like, cause we're a couple years out of the film now, you know, I guess just barely. And we've been keeping in contact. But you know, it's also weird to kind of say things on the record about, you know, this person that you had this pretty intimate take at for this mm-hmm. whole time, you know what I mean? So I don't want to go too far in that because I I love this guy more than most people on earth, and you know, I think that's one of the more incredible things about Dave is just that he's pretty open with the you know, like the struggles and the things that he's bad at. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I think like you were saying before, that's probably like the thing that helps him the most and hurts him the most, that one right. lane, like that's how he wrote the records right. that like changed my life. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like he had to go all in on who he was at that moment. And so that's probably why he's that same way on Twitter or whatever, like he's going to be all in on who he is. And that's how that, I mean, and that's what those lyrics were. Like, I mean, when he was writing that, like Winners Never Quit, I mean, he became that character, right? Or those, you know, one character, he was just, it was, the songs were the whole thing. So I think that's probably the why he has to do that. But also,
well, and even you know, I think even musically, you know, it's like,
yeah,
Aaron, you're talking about his drumming, you know, it's just like, that's a unique fucking drummer, you know, like there's just,
yep,
it's a completely different thing. Like I remember for the film, I went and, you know, like devoured kind of everything that people were doing on YouTube, you know, whether it was covers or whatever. And there was like so many people that were trying to do drums from Control and fucking it up. And, yeah, you know, like, and it's so frustrated because it's so specific and it's so like, you know, it's just him. It's just straight out of his head, which I think it makes it really hard to play with him, you know, and all this stuff, but it's also what makes the stuff rise above and, you know, change people's lives.
Yeah, he definitely has the ability to influence other people. So like he must feel that and know that because he's going to be influential as a person in whatever way he is. People will pay attention to what he does for whatever reason. He has the compulsion to be, you know, influential people typically are hidden because the more influence you have, the more you curate what people see. That's the pattern. And he violates that pattern by some kind of, it seems like a compulsion because it doesn't even seem to do him good in a lot of cases. And it's clearly, you know, it clearly, he suffers through it sometimes, you can tell.
Right.
Yeah.
Control is the greatest drum record of all time. I've said that for a while now.
I think people in the label group seem to agree. I think I've seen a lot of people have said stuff like that.
I was real drunk when I was tour managing y'all, and I think we played El Corazon or something. We were in that sidebar, and Sprinkle was there, and I'd never met Sprinkle. And I walked up to him hammered. It's like, hey man, like Control, man, how'd y'all do that? Like what was that? How'd you make that record or something? Like, you know, it's the best record ever. And Spring was like, it was like just us butting heads basically.
Yeah.
Like, and I was like, he was like, almost like he doesn't like it in a way. Yeah. Like, yeah, I didn't really get what I wanted out of that record.
The way Sprinkle tells that story is that Bazan did most of it at his house by himself, but he wanted Aaron to help and then to help mix it. So then Aaron started getting involved. And so then Aaron was mixing. It was on that small room at the compound on the right side. And it was before that. I'm sorry. It was at the old compound, but it was on the console that was in there. It's an old digital Sony console. And so Sprinkle, it was getting it all mixed up or whatever. And then whenever Sprinkle would go to the bathroom, Dave would jump on and change a bunch of stuff. And then and then act like he didn't do it. And they'd fight about it, too much compression or whatever.
But that's kind of the story of like all of the records, you know. And even when it was like, you know, because I was up in Cottage Grove, Oregon, with Dave. Another thing that didn't make it into the film, but there's like a couple beautiful scenes that came out of it, was Dave recording a record with Swift at National Freedom. And, you know, like the way that it was so interesting because, you know, so this is the record is Blanco that, you know, I'm talking about. And the way that they interacted was so interesting. And, you know, it was like, it was just perfect for a one-on-one kind of thing because like it couldn't, there couldn't have been another voice in the room, period. And, you know, like it was really beautiful watching them work together. But I couldn't imagine without Richard's like understanding of Dave and just kind of like they had this language that was, you know, born out of 20 years of friendship and musical relationship that they kind of got to things very quickly. But, you know, like watching Dave jump onto things and, you know, like it's not a hands-off process. And so, you know, like that's, That was one of the last records that Swift made before he died, actually.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with Blanco, really, actually. Do y'all listen to that one?
I don't know it. I'm sorry.
I think I haven't even kept up with everything since the what's the one with the bike song? Is that Blanco? My little brown bike.
That's the new
Blanco's before that.
Yeah, that's the new record. That's Phoenix.
Phoenix. Yeah, I guess I kind of miss Blanco. I don't think I ever spent any time with that one. Do you like that one a lot, Brandon?
Yeah, I mean, there's some really interesting stuff. Half of it is kind of redone from the monthly stuff. And it was kind of like, I think it was the last Barzook record. So there was a certain amount of like, you know, getting that. Well, I'm not actually sure exactly how that worked and who released that, but there were some songs that were redone, you know, like Impermanent Record, the track that opens Strange Negotiations is redone on this record, called Permanent Record, in a really interesting way. But you know, there is a song called The Ballad of Pedro y Blanco, you know, which is very much about his relationship, and marriage. And so, I mean, it's a Dave record, you know, like it's worth fucking with.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Speaking of his marriage, I was thinking about it today, cause I mean, he tweeted about it, that him and his wife had split up, or they were getting divorced or whatever. And I was thinking all the like documentaries and film stuff captures a moment and it tells you a lot about a person, but then their life keeps on going. Like,
yeah,
a lot has happened. Like you said, y'all made this film and it's been about, you're 2 years out or whatever. And in that 2 years, a lot has changed for him. Like, you could have done a documentary in the last 2 years of him.
Yeah.
It would have been just as interesting, if not more interesting. Isn't that crazy? Like, you spent all this time capturing a moment that was really awesome. It showed so much about this person that is one of the biggest musical influences of my entire life. And I was so blown away by the doc. I just watched it. Loved it. It's so great. I'm glad it's on Prime now, right?
That's awesome. Yeah.
His life just kept right on going, and things got better and worse and amazing.
Yeah, well, imagine if you made a documentary about Donald Trump in 2013.
Right. and then in 2021, the second one in 2021. Unbelievable.
Well, that's the thing, you know, like, and I feel like I've been pretty lucky in terms of finding, you know, and that's like, that's the documentarian's role, is like kind of understanding when it's right to tell the story and when it's not. And I honestly think that this was the only time that, you know, to follow Dave warranted a film. You know, because like there was part of me that, well, I was kind of understanding all of this history, I was like, fuck, man, I wish it, you know, like it would have been so amazing to get this loss of faith and kind of in the moment. And, you know, like as sad and dark as it is, this alcoholism and, you know, like all the good time Dave that led into, you know, like all of these problems, but, you know, like be able to capture it through my lens rather than having to kind of, you know, go grab like a bunch of archival footage. But then, you know, it was like, that's not actually the story. You know, and then it's like, oh, it would be so interesting to, you know, at the end of the film, Dave is talking about his current view of spirituality and kind of where he's at and how things are kind of coming together in really interesting ways. So is it more interesting to kind of like go and grab that, like what that progression looks like into, you know, like him and his wife going back to church a little bit and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, like that relationship not working out. And, you know, but it's like, I don't know. I think that it's so hard to make a movie.
Yeah. You well, know, it's clear. Like, he has his demons. I mean, I guess we all do.
Right. It's funny. Well, it's so hard to find a movie's worth of story, you know, and conflict and resolution and the things that move us and change us. And this was the period in Dave's life that I think, you know, was the most ripe for this thing. And I am committed to being a friend and an ally on either side of that. But, you know, I don't think it's as film worthy.
Sure. It's funny. I think some of the stuff, like he toured for so long by himself in a van. And
right.
When I was doing these events, these True Man events, and I'll just be in the van by myself for most of the day. And then I go to hang out with this group of men for, you know, a couple hours, and then I go back by myself. And I end up I just prefer sleeping in my van. I don't have to worry about getting up at somebody's house or, you know, all that stuff. And Dave had his van all hooked up and was touring completely by himself. And it's like being out there by myself. I just thought about so much stuff, and I didn't call anybody. And at first, when I first started touring or doing that, some of that, it would be like, you know, I was doing it maybe like 7 days in a row, just like 7 days. And the first 2 days, I would be calling people, I'd be talking to them and stuff. But by day three, I didn't care about talking to people, and I would just be by myself. And I would go through all these emotions. It wasn't like I was super sad or anything, but it would just be like you're just there driving on the road, and you know where you got to go, and then you got to go to this store or this gas station or whatever, and I just didn't want to talk to anybody, and it was just me. Yeah. I'd just rather just talk to myself.
That sounds like it was good for you, right? Like it has to feel healthy, right? It has to be.
Nah, I don't think it did. To me, I think being around people, because, I mean, the True Man is really neat at these events specifically. I do feel a level of comfort with those people.
About the, just like a general context on the True Man events.
It's just I go to people's living rooms, and it's like probably 10 guys, or, you know, a little less, a little more, and we just do this event for about manhood, masculinity. We do some a few different exercises and stuff like that. But
a living room show with no music.
Yeah,
right.
Got it.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm spreading toxic masculinity. No, yeah. When I first get there, I do have to kind of be on. Feel like I'm a little bit of an entertainer, you know, because everybody's there. Nobody hardly knows each other. So I get to be that entertainer for a little bit, and then I hang out a little bit, and then I leave, and I go by myself again.
That's the crazy part of the living room thing, that it's so different from. You know, and I got to experience this firsthand following this thing, because I did club tours with him and I did living room tours with him, you know, where it's just kind of like you have a house full of people in fucking Gainesville, Florida, that are just, you know, like waiting and expecting. And in the film, there is one, and again, another kind of deleted scene was that Dave forgot his fucking guitar at the hotel.
Oh no.
So and, you know, it's just like, I'm such a people pleaser, and, you know, like as a documentarian, like I'm such an empath, I guess, you know, like this shit fucks me up, like people's expectations. And, you know, he was just like so cool with being like, yo, I forgot my guitar. And Yuki Matthews was out at that point, who's, you know, an incredible musician. He's part of the Shins. He's been in a bunch of different bands. But so he kind of had to stay in this house and make everyone happy while Dave and I went back to, you know, whatever fucking hotel and grabbed his guitar. And it was just like, he wasn't worried at all.
Poor Yuki. And,
but then we got back and Yuki was just like, what's up, guys? And it was, you know, like, I just, so, you know, like my experience with music and performance and stuff had come from touring with, you know, like bigger bands before that. You know, like I toured most extensively with my cousin's band, Pearl Jam. And, you know, like it was just... you know, like that. I did that when I was.
You can't just skate over that. What do you mean, your cousin?
Yeah. So,
what are you talking about? You just hung out with your cousin, but it happened to be Pearl Jam. Yeah. So,
I've never gotten good at this, at rolling into this thing, because it was like, you know, like I came of age when it was the biggest thing in the world. You know, so Ed is my cousin.
Eddie Vedder is your cousin.
Yeah. Eddie Vedder.
Good old Ed.
So, yeah, he lived with us, you know, for a little bit. And he, yeah, you know, like he, if you were going to be related to someone famous, like, he's the guy.
But, but at one point, he was just your cousin, Eddie. Right, just your cousin A that you played or hung out with. I mean, is he older than you, younger than you? What was the?
Yeah, he's older. You know, him and his brothers. Well, you know, it's like I don't know how big a fans or if you guys are fans at all, but 10 kind of tells the story of, you know, what happened with my aunt and uncle, and you know, Ed. He was the son of a person that he didn't know. And so, you know, like all of the brothers, there's 4 brothers in that family, 3 now, rest in peace, Chris. They all thought that they were of the same father. And there was this friend who was a musician who would come over and kind of check on the family and everyone every once in a while. And he got cancer and ended up dying. And that, you know, my Aunt Karen made it clear that that was, man, I did not think I was going to get into such family drama. Seriously?
Well, I just thought you were going to tell us about all the boobs you got to see on tour. you took it dark. This is heavy. Good Lord. Yeah, was there any good fun touring stories? Well, any better Pearl Jam?
You got a couple wild ones. We can't skip all the way past Aunt Karen now.
No, it's not, there's nothing. My Aunt Karen, you know, she had, there was a, and it's so interesting because now she is kind of the keeper of our family lineage, which I've been meaning to kind of check on recently because I've been trying to figure a couple things out because our family is, you know, like, especially this side is pretty crazy. And we come from a wild, wild bunch. And so anyway, Ed did not know who his father was until super late in his life. And that's what was the inspiration for most of the record 10.
Wow.
And then, yeah, I forget you guys got to kind of keep me on track because we're going so many other places.
We're very relaxed on time and all this, but it's funny to already stumble into this territory given, I mean, Eddie Vedder and Dave Bazan, I mean, are probably two of the most people who I would, I mean, have caught, you know, directly contributed to our paths. I mean, like,
is that right?
Well, I mean, just in the whole scheme of things, I mean, that's,
I gotta call my wife and tell her I'm talking to Eddie Vedder's cousin. She's gonna lose her fucking mind.
But yeah, I mean, when 10 came out for us, I mean, that was like the beginning. Like, I didn't turn into a person until I heard Nirvana, and then it was Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Stone Temple Pilots, and then I'm here today. I'm a rock guitarist from Seattle. I mean, it's just it's almost that simple, you know. And then when I was gonna move here, it's like, well, Dave Bazan's from Seattle too, and at that time he was like a hero of mine. So the very first exposure to music was grunge, and I said, that's me. I'm grunge no matter what. I know that's me. And then Dave Bazan later for the Vulnerability and Authenticity, and they're both in Seattle, you know. And so I moved to Seattle, and then eventually I meet Dave relatively early on in that journey and get to know him and that kind of thing. And it's a very small scene up here, even the Pearl Jam. And I know people that work for Pearl Jam and have known them. I didn't know that you were his cousin, though, by the way. We didn't know that.
Really?
Here. And then, you know, when I first moved here, I also went out. Here's a good one. I forgot about this one. I'll tell it another time. But I dated Jimi Hendrix's niece when I first moved to Seattle. So if that's not – okay, Eddie Vedder's cousin. I know Dave Bazan. I went out with Jimi Hendrix's niece, Tina.
Boy from the South does good. That's what that headline's called. Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because – We were living in Lake Tahoe at that point when Ed was living with us, and we had, I mean, I'm just drunk enough to tell the whole story. Where it's like, my parents were pretty big drug dealers, and we all, the Vedders, come from Chicago, and so we, Ed and Karen and everyone, moved to San Diego. We moved to Lake Tahoe, and so it was this really interesting timing where, you know, like, Flea and, you know, like, if I do all this research, you know, like, tapes are being pushed back and forth between all of these bands, and he's in Mookie Blaylock at that point, and you know, like, there he brought up, like, the first version of, like, what he was really you know, it was like so interesting. We had this cabin in South Lake Tahoe where my dad, who's the craziest motherfucker in the world, where it's like that's where all the drug dealing comes from. He made, you know, so an A-frame has a triangle upstairs, and he stapled mattresses to the walls on either side and on the bottom. So we had like this crazy pillow fight room, and that's where Ed stayed. And so I just remember like him showing me these tapes, and it had all, like, he had written everything on these tapes, and it had this really specific look to it that I could kind of even tell, you know, like, as an 8 or 9 or 10 year old, like, oh wow, like, this is history, like, this is something special.
Mm-hmm. And so,
Brandon, why did your dad staple mattresses to the ceiling? why did he do that? Are you there, Brandon? Did we lose him? I think we lost him.
Oh God! No,
no, I'm back. I'm back.
I have to know that. That is wild. First of all, what the hell kind of stapler did your dad have? My
God, what big ass stapler!
That's the biggest fucking stapler.
Yeah,
but it was a pillow fight room. Your dad had an idea to throw you off of any wall, ceiling. That's amazing.
Exactly. Yeah. Like that was the thing.
I didn't miss anything.
With my dad, who his name is Freddie Vedder.
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. He and he will show up at any Pearl Jam show and push his way past the, you know, like Pete, Ed, security guard, and all this stuff, because it's like, you know, like Ed's a weird factor in our family where, you know, it's like everyone is, I don't know. There's this, it's a weird thing to have someone that famous in your family when you're really, really poor. You know, like when Ed was his most famous, we were on food stamps, you know, like, so it was there was this weird thing where, and not that there was any like we didn't even think about that or whatever, but it was just kind of like, it was weird.
So Freddie go backstage, demand to go backstage. Is like, who are you? I am Freddie Vedder, and then just demand to be let back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yep.
Absolutely. Come on, beat it, buddy. Freddie Vedder.
Yeah, get out of here. You couldn't come up with a better name than that. Yeah.
You just put an F in front of that motherfucker. So,
yeah, sure. You're related to Eddie Vedder. You best you come. I'm his relative. I'm Freddie Vedder. You see.
Well, and that was the thing. Like, I graduated high school. I reached out to Ed, and I was like, "Yo, I think you know, like, this is what makes the most sense for me in terms of telling stories and like." I was so interesting. There was like, I toured with Wu-Tang Clan. You know, like there was a handful of things that I was doing because, you know, like hip hop is my first love, in terms of just like capturing and trying to tell that story and understand or just like, I don't feel like there's no like hip hop documentaries. That's like Wilco, I'm trying to break your heart or something like this, where it's just like, I understand the songwriting. Like
it's not as much a part of the hip hop culture to do storytelling and the vulnerable inside look stuff.
Right. Mm. And so with the project that I'm working on now, that's a big part of it. Remind me what your question was.
We're still on your tour. You're still on your
What'd
tour.
What'd you do for Pearl Jam? The crazy story.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
What was your job at Pearl Jam? And what? Give us a crazy story if you got one. Memory.
Well, okay. So my job for Pearl Jam was, you know, like, me and Ed are from similar spots where it's just like, we're not, you know, like blessed in terms of family or money or anything like that. And so motherfucker did not talk to me once the entire tour. I went on tour with them for 7 or 8 months.
He didn't talk to you the whole time.
No, did not talk to me once. He, and he was like super pumped by the end that I had become part of the crew. But, you know, it was like I was the youngest person by maybe 20 years, you know, like, I was 18, 19 years old. So yeah, there wasn't really anyone. I became friends with like security guys, and one of the most amazing people in the world is this woman named Carrie Keys, who runs Rat Sound along with her partner Dave Rat, who has this incredible organization called Sound Girls, where she is encouraging and kind of providing a path for women to be doing front of house shit and like really getting into, you know, like the real fucking sonic jobs and not just like, you know, local crew shit. So she was like one of my saving graces, and you know, but at the end of the day, I was, what brought me on this entire thing was you were saying that there, you had those moments where you were in these cities and you were alone, and this is, you know, kind of this entirely different thing. You know, like that's kind of the first time that I experienced that, where I was touring the country and then the world, and I was 10 years junior everyone else, and they kind of thought I was a douchebag because I was Ed's cousin. They didn't know that, you know, I was
Is that why he didn't talk to you, so that he could let you kind of find your own way, I guess? Okay, so, I got you.
Yeah, you know, but, you know, like, yeah, I was this poor, chubby food stamps kid.
And what were you doing on the tour? What was your day-to-day job?
So I was shooting every night, and then I would set up the dressing room. And that put me in some really interesting positions.
I bet.
I got to like watch and understand so many famous people and the kind of despair that is there.
Wow. That stuck with you right away. You were saying when you were 20 and you're like, oh, these people have it all and they're miserable.
Miserable.
Yeah. Tell me more.
Okay, let's see if we. Okay. You know. Okay. Here's what we'll do. Let's guess some famous people's names that you saw in the despair, and you say yes or no. Yeah. Okay.
Please,
ready?
Please throw me some firewood, because I feel like I'm just. It's hard to gauge where I just like I'm continuing to drink here on
what
vacation.
What are you drinking tonight? And you're on vacation. You deserve it. But what are you drinking?
Elijah Craig.
Nice. Ooh.
Yeah.
Nice.
So this was, let's see, 2002 to 2004.
Okay.
So it was the Riot Act tour, and then I went and unhung on a couple of Ed's solo things with the Sean Penn movie.
Cool.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
That is a good, that is a super good guess. No, Emile
Hirsch.
That's
the only Sean Penn movie I can think of. Out of all of his movies. That's the,
I know.
That was it.
Oh boy. It's good. I mean, you went, you shot your shot.
I did.
It was Into the Wild. So Ed did a bunch of music for Into the Wild.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
That's right. Emile
Hirsch, Sean Penn movie.
Yep.
And yeah, so I think we were living in LA at that point, and I just kind of hung out for a little bit during that thing. So yeah, we did probably like a national and international tour on the Riot Act record.
Okay. Toby, you got some?
Sorry, I'm back.
Yeah, Toby reconnected there. No problem.
Yeah, my internet connection was unstable. I'm sorry. Anyway, so I was thinking,
how much do you guys edit this thing?
We're just being silly. We're just loose and silly. It's nothing to it.
Because this seems very dangerous to me.
Well, I mean, if there's anything you said you don't want to say, we're happy to take it
out.
But what dangerous in what way though?
Well, I don't know. I mean, honestly, more dangerous in terms of the Dave stuff because he can be, yeah, more. You know, it's like I'm not concerned about Ed. That all that stuff is fine and fun, but the Dave, well, no, I think we're fine. I think we're okay. As long as you cut this shit out.
we can give it to you to review if you like.
No, Brandon, I'm having a hell of a time.
This is great.
I promise you. But this is just so interesting. I really want to know, you're 20 years younger than these people on tour. You're on tour with Pearl Jam, and they're massive. But what, I mean, were you partying hard? Was it wild? No, or were you just on a crew bus and it was boring? They're all older.
This is good, actually. This is the first time I've ever told this story publicly. I was it's hard to say exactly, but a Christian. When
you're in the right place.
When I went on this tour and I was trying to be a light of Christ, I was like worried that if I was to drink or, you know, like that all of these people I got that indoctrination as a young dude.
You're a witness. Like,
yeah, like I had this incredible, you know, like, and then it was just like, you're a poor kid, you're, you know, like brown appearing, you have very little to give. What are you going to do? And so, you know, like I was so sensitive about what I was putting out in terms of, you know, like this Christian thing where it was like, okay, like, you know, every we had all this money coming to us in terms of, you know, like our per diem, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I'm a poor kid. So I was just like, this is insane. Like getting $75 a day or whatever it was, like, this is so insane. And everyone else is like going to strip clubs and whatever they're doing was fine. I was just like, this is great. Like, I'm going to film school and I'm going to do it and I'm going to save all this money up. And yeah, I don't know where I was going with that.
You had us on the edge of our seat as a storyteller. We're right there with you.
I'd pay anything. I'd pay anything to know where
me.
If I could get to where you were going, I'd pay anything to know now. That's a storyteller.
Well, you know, there is this thing where, can you guys still hear me?
Yep.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So there was this moment in New York. We're at Madison Square Garden and this show goes off and it is, you know, like I'm shooting side stage. Show was unbelievable. Like people were moving in a way that was fucking this building up. And I was side stage with my camera. I'm still trying to film and not getting a steady shot. I look backstage at the garden and, you know, they have to have ambulances in there. And the ambulances are almost bouncing off of their shocks. Like, they are just bouncing. And you'll see this entire story if you ever watch the Live at the Garden Pearl Jam DVD. But the tour manager came out and said, there's only three bands that have ever made Madison Square Garden shake like this. The Boss, Iron Maiden, you know, and like the crowd is going apeshit. It was an incredible moment.
It sounds like it.
The beautiful thing is that you guys are going to have to make a podcast out of this.
This is the podcast. I don't know what you mean by that.
Wait, you don't edit this at all?
We'll keep as loose as we can.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Is that, you know, we hang out and talk and have conversation, and then we release that as a podcast and we edit to the degree we must. Well, so how about since the movie has been released? I mean, it's been out for a while now. Tell us about how the reception has been since you were last on the podcast.
Well, it's been great. I mean, you know, like, it's one of these things where it's just like, if people find the film, they are moved by it. But, you know, like, we're in this world where there's just so much stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, there's very few ways to just stumble upon a movie about this guy and his songs and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I worked super hard while we were making the film to engage like this big audience. But, you know, like, once that audience is gone, it's kind of like, all right, well, I hope someone else stumbles upon this thing. And so that's where we are with Amazon Prime right now, where it's just like, there's 500 people every day so far. We're 15 days in.
That's awesome.
Just, you know, like, stumbling upon
discovery. Yeah, that's cool. So yeah, it's had its whole run of doing the film festivals and the showings and the fans and everything. And now, I mean, who knows? I mean, that could be people that don't even know Bazan and become fans and everything at that point once you're on the
right
in the mainstream content house.
And that's the hard thing, you know, like, with my past films as well, you know, like, we've done, you know, like, the biggest film festivals, the biggest press outlets, everything that you would think that would, like, determine success. And it's not the thing anymore, you know, like, it's a completely different metric now. And so, having New York Times and LA Times and, you know, like, all of these critics say, this is the best thing that you'll ever watch, does not matter.
Yeah, but on the flip side of that, the meaning and value that the people that do get it and know about it is so deep. Like, it's like the amount of people that really care about Bazan and the film you made and that scene and the living room shows and the post-Christian right. this and that level yeah. of detail, you know, that narrow of an audience has never gotten before this level of niche content that so deeply matters to them. So it's a little bit of a trade-off that a general people maybe aren't looking for it, but it's really amazing that that whole community itself can support and generate and, you know, have this stuff such that it can even get to be on Amazon Prime for free like it is now. So I think that's quite amazing regardless, you know, of how the industry is.
Totally. And, you know, like, I think it's so interesting and fun to watch, like, Kirsten Demen's book, you know, Jesus and John Wayne, become, you know, like, this crazy hit where, you know, it's like there are all of these things in this world that, I don't know, I think that people are just really kind of starting to understand now and starting to,
yeah,
there's a lot of things that people are just starting to deal with, you know, like, and it's a beautiful time.
I watched it today, and it is a great documentary, regardless if you know about Bazan or whatever. It was just really well made. But I thought you should have had a trigger warning for band dudes that have wives and kids. Because it was, I'm serious. I watched it and he kept having to pause it because I was making my kids dinner and trying to get them to bed and all that stuff. And I was watching, I don't like to feel stuff. Like I don't want to feel any emotions. And my band spent a lot of pre-pandemic, we spent 2 years before that on the road a lot. And I have kids that are of an age, you know, 3, 5, and 8 now. And I like, it felt traumatic to me to watch Dave dealing with that. Cause I was like, oh, that's such an awful feeling. Realizing that like you've carved yourself into some life that you can't get out of, kind of, and you're like, you know what I mean? Like it was dark. It was dark to watch. So I didn't like, I liked the film. I did not like how I felt.
Well, the whole film feels super heavy. It just, from the beginning, it just feels super heavy. And you're like, and Brandon, you don't let anybody escape from that. There's not really much, there's not much reprieve or relief through it. And it just kind of goes, which is kind of cool. That tension and heaviness being there the whole time really does make you feel something. Like you do feel connected when he can't throw the baseball with his kid, or he's going to get, his wife, I think one of the lines is his wife goes, oh, well, you'll be home for like 2 of his games or 3 of his games, something like that. And I was like, and he was like, oh yeah, he just said it. But you know, the underlying thing is, well, that's just the other ones. He isn't going to be there.
Right. That's like, you'll parole by then is what it sounds like.
I missed my son's first little league T-ball season, the whole thing. I didn't see a single game because I was on tour. That killed me.
Yikes.
Yeah. It's awful.
Wow. Well, it's on Amazon Prime now, and I'm hopeful that the artistic people like you making stuff are partnering with the algorithms, and then the right people will continue to discover it. But it's free. That's amazing. So if anybody hadn't seen this film, please go do it right now. You can do one of those watch parties or whatever.
I had two things I'd like to say before we wrap up here.
Go ahead, Toby.
Three things.
Three?
Brandon, first of all, Brandon, thank you so much for joining us, my friend.
During your vacation.
Thoroughly enjoyed it. Two, when you said, y'all were talking, like, lunch, you said you didn't get to see your son's first whole T-ball season. I was trying to think of something, and since the day she was born, I haven't been able to see my firstborn at all. Because of touring in this podcast.
You still haven't met her.
You, big whoop, one season of T-ball. Right?
Now she's upstairs.
Yeah, but this damn
this is important,
podcast.
Though. This is
my
important.
My wife keeps saying something, send me letters about being deadbeat. I don't know. I wish to God my job didn't keep me away from her. But it does, okay? Now, secondly, Brandon, if you'll allow me, I would like to be two of your coworkers. I'm just envisioning when you were playing Madison Square Garden, I would like to be two of your coworkers talking about the moment and you and what's happening. If y'all will let me do that. You ready?
Like a role play?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Here we go. This is Brandon.
Yeah, do it.
This is Brandon's coworkers at the Madison Square Garden. Hey, Martin, who's that new kid over there, Brandon? What do you mean? That's Eddie's cousin. Eddie's Eddie's cousin. Wait, you mean Freddie's son? Freddie with the mattresses stapled all over the fucking ceiling and everywhere. God, that's Freddie's kid. Scene.
Is that, Brandon, is that basically
Brandon,
accurate?
Brandon, did I get close to your cover? What?
No.
Damn it. I thought I nailed that one. Shit. All right.
But I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I did my best, guys. I did my best.
Brandon, right. Thank you for spending time with us tonight. This has been really fun.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
See you, Brandon.
Bye, Brandon.
Peace.
Matt and Toby.